Good evening and welcome to another edition of Midwest Beat. I'm your host, Tom Lounges. Tonight is a show not originally on our schedule, but fate has its way of changing things around. Guitar great Alan Holdsworth was originally scheduled to be the final guest of my five-week International Guitar Month series. He should have been on the show May 2nd. Sadly, before we had a chance to interview Alan and support his new 12-CD box set, he passed away over Easter weekend. But tonight, we are going to remember Alan Holdsworth with Marco Villarreal. He is a regional guitar slinger out here. He can play all the different styles. We also have Chris Horde, who is an associate producer. He's also been helping out on the box set by writing the liner notes. All of that is coming up with Alan's music after this. Good evening and welcome to Midwest Beat. I'm your host, Tom Lounges. This program is all about music and the people who make it. As I mentioned prior to the news, tonight's show was not originally on our schedule, but fate has made it so. Guitar great Alan Holdsworth was originally scheduled to be the final guest of my five-week International Guitar Month series, and he was to appear on the air with me on the May 2nd program. I expect that we would have chatted about his amazing 40-plus years in music, his new solo career encompassing 12-CD box set, which was aptly titled Alan Holdsworth, The Man Who Changed Guitar Forever. It was released just a few weeks ago. He's also got a new 2-CD set called Eidolon, and it contains 28 songs that were handpicked by Alan himself, personal favorites from his catalog. Well, sadly, Alan is not with us. He passed away Easter weekend, just a few days before we were to have him on the show. So instead, we are paying tribute and remembering the impact this great guitar player had on music, especially jazz. With me in studio to help me do that is Marco Villarreal of Northwest Indiana in Chicagoland. He is a phenomenal guitar player in his own right. We've also got a phone call coming our way from California with Chris Horde. Chris was Alan Holdsworth's project assistant. He actually assistant produced some of the albums, and he is the author of the detailed liner notes on the 12-CD box set. But while we get Chris on the phone, let's take it with the Red Alert. We'll be right back. It's a red alert. The late, great Alan Holdsworth, and I believe that was off the Believe album. And with me now on phone, we've got a gentleman that spent a lot of time with Alan. We have the one and only Mr. Chris Hoard. Chris, are you with us?
Good afternoon.
Oh, there you are.
Sorry about that.
Oh, no problem. Chris, thank you so much for joining us. You are calling in from California, correct?
I am. I'm calling from dreary Orange County, which is usually sunny.
Okay, it's kind of dreary here too, so maybe the gods are crying because of the topic we're talking about tonight. With me in studio, I've got Marco Villarreal. Marco is a jazz fusion guitar player and had a chance to meet Alan and is kind of mentored, I guess you'd say, musically through his albums. Say hello, Marco.
Hello, everybody.
So we are going to talk guitar. We're going to talk about Alan Holdsworth with a gentleman that was inspired to play guitar by Alan in part, and also someone who worked with him, Chris Hoard. Now, Chris, you actually produced some of the stuff with him, co-produced, correct?
Yeah, I did. We did an Archival Live album called Then, which was the only live album he chose to include on his box set. The new box set that's out called The Man Who Changed Guitar Forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I also worked with him on an earlier best of collection, which was called Against the Clock, where we remastered a whole bunch of tracks. And there was another third project I worked on him, which is a demo of my own of some compositions I wrote for him, which was called Riptide. So a few projects along the way, and then I was in the studio, you know, for most of the music that he recorded during his solo career in California.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the one that he recorded in England, his first project called IOU.
Wow. And, of course, UK was a big project. That's where I first discovered his playing, was when he was with UK with Bill Bruford.
Yeah, myself as well, actually.
I'm an old rock guy from commercial rock radio, and when they came out, I was like, wow, this is a really cool jazzy meets rock kind of thing I can get away with playing on classic rock stations.
Yeah, and in fact, that I thought that was a wonderful opening selection you had from the Tony Williams New Lifetime, which just kind of turned the jazz world on its head as much as the UK turned the rock world on its head when people first heard Alan.
Mm-hmm. Marco, when did you first discover Alan's music?
Well, I was in a guitar lesson, and my guitar teacher at the time was working on one of Alan's solos from the song Devil Take the Hindmost. And I walked in as he was kind of mimicking it, and then he just stopped and he said, well, why don't you just listen to this? And I was immediately just floor, just like anybody else.
Now, how old were you at that point?
I was probably like 15 years old.
So that was something completely foreign to what we were hearing on radio at that point.
For sure, yeah. And ever since I first heard that, I was immediately hooked, and still am.
Now, you know, Alan has influenced so many people, his style, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of the unique things that he brought to guitar. But Eddie Van Halen in particular has gone to the wall saying, if it hadn't been for Alan Holdsworth, he wouldn't be here playing guitar as he is. Same thing with Richie Kotzen and Joe Satriani and just so many other guitar players over the years. Why do you think that Alan never got the recognition from the public, per se? He mentored so many, and all the greats claim him as their influence. Chris, why do you think he never got the amount of fame that obviously was due him?
Well, it's funny. Before I attended the memorial service, I got an email from Tony Williams' wife, and I was thinking about that and what might be the words that might best address that. And I'm going to quote, this was a private message she sent, but I'm going to quote one sentence here that I think is maybe right on point for me.
Okay.
Alan saved our world from the mundane, from the rear view mirror gazing, the derivative, the sterility of safe. He saw the future and made it happen. And I, you know, that might sound portentous to some, but for me, he was uncompromising in a way. He wasn't willing to, I mean, I was with him when he got an offer from Steely Dan to go on tour, you know, and they asked him to come out and do an audition. And he said, well, if they don't know who I am now, you know, I probably shouldn't go out and do the audition. But what I am saying is he had to forge his own path, and he was uncompromising as an artist. And so, you know, doing something that was popular or more appealing, well, he did do some things. He played a huge series of concerts as a member of Level 42. His friend Gary Husband was the drummer and a musician he mentored. His choices were usually towards exploration rather than trying to reach a mass audience.
Mm-hmm. Now, Marco, you yourself being a fusion guitar player, and you were in the show a few months ago with a new project you had done in L.A., and that was definitely different, shall we say. Do you share that sentiment that to take the music to where it needs to go as opposed to resting on laurels and doing what's been done?
You just go with your own thing, but when it comes to a tremendous artist like Alan Holdsworth, you know, he pretty much leads the way.
Now, you had the opportunity a few years ago to sit down with Alan at NAMM, and what did you leave that conversation with? What nuggets of knowledge or wisdom did you take away from that conversation?
Really nothing. It was just a spur of the moment thing where he happened to be in the same room as I, and it was just a pleasure to meet him. That's what it was. I was just a fan. I'm a huge fan. And he was just kind enough to, you know, share a few moments of his time. You know, he's phenomenal.
Now, Chris, when these other guitar players would come up to Alan, you know, Eddie and Joe and all these people, and say, you know, Alan, you've influenced me so much, you've done this, and just gush about his talents, how did he take that? He seems, from what I've read and what I've seen of him, a very humble man.
Humble is putting it lightly. I would say self-deprecating to a fault. I've seen many people, you know, famous and otherwise, come up to him and say, Alan, what you just played was the most amazing thing I've ever heard come out of a guitar. And he would look them straight in the eye and say, I'm really sorry you had to hear that. So when I say uncompromising, I mean he was the most self-critical artist I've ever encountered, and maybe sometimes that got in his way. You know, sometimes he would work for weeks and weeks on a single guitar solo, and I mean we all have a recorded legacy to hear what he did, and you know, much of it is just absolutely breathtaking.
Mm-hmm.
but at the same time, I think he was his own worst critic, and that, you know, it is what it is, but at the same time, he was always pushing himself to be better, to go farther, and that, you know, if that wasn't a part of his nature, I think his contribution would have been different and maybe not quite as spectacular as it is.
Okay. One of the things that made him unique was the synth acts that he masterfully played. I don't think anyone has ever come close to anything like that. Let's play a cut. You had mentioned Against the Clock, and this features Vinnie Colaiuta of the Mothers of Invention. I'm a big Zappa fan, and Vinnie spent a lot of time with them. Is there any story for this song before we play it?
Well, I think Alan and Vinnie had gone on a short tour, and Alan was a big fan of Indian food, as most British people are, and he had a nickname for Vinnie called Vindaloo. That was like one of the hotter dishes, and Alan was just a huge fan of Vinnie and his playing, and a friend of Frank Zappa, and two drummers from that were referred by Frank to Alan, one being Vinnie and the other being Chad Wackerman, who worked with Alan over his whole career. So I would just say they had a very special rapport and relationship, and this track has some of that dynamic in it, I think, that they captured in the studio.
All right, this is Against the Clock. We'll be back with Marco and Chris and talk more Alan music right after this.
A dream of flying like the wind against the clock.
We are racing against the clock. Show's almost half over already. We're just starting to get into it. Alan Holdsworth is our topic. He is one of the great guitar players you may never have heard of, but you're certainly hearing him tonight. He was a huge influence on so many of the players that are out there in every genre, as Marco and I were talking off air, of music. I mean, he impacted it all, whether it was metal or jazz or even country. I mean, pretty much everything he did, kind of like Chet Atkins and some of the other greats that were on the scene as well, your fingerprints are left behind, and that is a legacy that Alan will always have. Joining us also is a gentleman that had the privilege of working with Alan, Chris Horde, who has co-produced as well as assisted on various projects, including the new 12 CD box set. I've got to ask you, Chris, when did he take to the synth acts? And how did he balance the two? Was there one that favored over the other, or did the song dictate what he played?
Well, I think, I believe it was in the late, mid to late 80s. Maybe he started experimenting with it in the mid 80s. Certainly by his fourth record, Metal Fatigue, which was his first fourth solo project, he was starting to work with guitar synthesizers. But then by the next album, which was called Sand, he pretty much, it wasn't that he'd stopped playing guitar, but I think that was, those next couple albums were where it was prominently featured, if not on most of the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
What was interesting in that track you just heard was he actually at one point hooked up a blow tube controller. He had always wanted to be a horn player.
Hmm.
As he said, he was more interested in shaping the sound after the note was played. He looked at the guitar as a percussion instrument, and he wanted to initially play the sax. And sort of the movement into syntax, I think, had two kind of significant aspects. One was actually how he used the synth controller and then elaborated on it with a blow tube. And then, which a lot of musicians found bizarre when they saw it in concert. I mean, first of all, the guitar itself, the controller looked like a spaceship to begin with, but then a guy playing it through a blow tube was certainly unique. And then secondly, Alan is just somebody, I think, that just as much as he's a crazy, fast soloist, is an orchestrator at heart. He listened to classical composers, and orchestrations quite a bit. I think he was influenced by Bartok and others. And so he had developed at a very early age this immense catalog of chord voicings. And that's really why he was very distinctive to a lot of guitarists. When they heard these chords he would play, they would just say, how could he do that? He had a huge left hand. And the first thing you noticed was just the speed at which he played a solo, and that he could do that over incredibly fast chord changes. But his chord voicings themselves were something that he wished to expand and add texture to, and he did that with the synth controllers.
Marco, you were telling me prior to the show that you've dabbled a little bit with synthesizers on your guitar, but nothing like Alan had done. What are your thoughts on the synthax as a player, and does it intimidate you to even attempt to do that after listening to Alan?
Of course. I would never attempt that. It's a beautiful sound, and it's just fantastic to hear individual like Alan just take that machine and make some of the most gorgeous music you've ever heard. I mean, some of those some of the textures and the melodic lines he would improvise on that thing were just unreal.
Now, the box set, which Chris was involved in putting together, The Man Who Changed Guitar Forever, that title says a lot. What was it, in your eyes, as a player, as a longtime player, do you think that he most brought change to? What is Alan probably best known for, if there is, to the guitar players?
Well, at least for me, and I would assume a lot of guitar players would agree that his technique, from the era he came out of in the fusion era where jazz and rock were kind of coming together, the other players, like there were other guys in the forefront, John McLaughlin, Larry Coryell, and even Al Di Meola, people like that, but they tended to pick every single note, which is a very percussive sound. It was a different sound. Alan was, I guess, one of the first guys to ever utilize the what's called the legato technique, where he's using both the pick and his left hand to make articulation sound. So in other words, you can get the note to sound out with a pick, or you can get it to sound out two ways with your left hand, either by what's called a hammer-on or a pull-off. And I think he was one of the first guys to really take that to a, no one was really doing that in that kind of music. I could be wrong, but that's one of the things that blew a lot of people away.
Chris, does that sound right to you?
Yeah, no, that's spot on. I mean, there were some early innovators that did things like that. I think there was a jazz player named Barney Kessel, but not quite in the way Alan did it, and so fluidly over such complex changes. Definitely that legato technique, I think, you know, he articulated it so clearly. And he did it with a distorted guitar, so when you heard, like, his work with Soft Machine and Tony Williams, it evolved, and then when he recorded with really it was almost another version of King Crimson without Robert Fripp, UK.
Right.
Those three guys had either performed or recorded with King Crimson, and Alan was known to them as the jazz musician. And when, you know, as Bill Bruford said, when he played that opening guitar solo on that record, it was like the guitar solo heard round the world, and just everybody's ears picked up. And I remember when I first heard that album, I just thought, what is that? Is that a violin, a guitar, a synthesizer? It just sounded so different. So it was not only the articulation, but kind of the refinement of the sound. And it was interesting because Alan could just plug in any old amp and get that sound, you know, to a greater or lesser degree. And I always thought it was kind of magic because no other guitarist, you know, at least up till that point, until they started copying him, could do that.
What was his favorite style? I mean, I think of him as a jazz player, but yet, like I said, I discovered him with UK, which was very much a rock sound. How did he look at himself? Did he cite himself in a certain genre?
Well, I think he saw himself as somebody who could play, you know, if he related to the music, in almost any genre, really. I mean, I think, you know, one album he loved, which was more of a sort of a classical oriented jazz album, was called Cityscape by the orchestrator Klaus Ogerman. And so I think if he had had the time and circumstance, he probably would have wanted to do an orchestral recording, and some of his synth acts works hearken to that. So at the same time, I mean, he loved Johnny Cash, and, you know, he loved Leonard Cohen. I mean, he had a very eclectic musical taste. I think maybe the most revealing thing I ever saw him do, one time I'd walked into the studio and, you know, I was just wondering, who did he woodshed on, you know?
Right.
And I heard him, just play some jazz guitar licks, and, you know, like a Charlie Christian.
Okay.
Lick, you know, and I realized that at some point when he was younger, he had studied some of the great jazz guitarists. But he said, you know, early Eric Clapton was as much an influence on him as anybody. So
I can hear a little Wes Montgomery in some of the tracks that I listen to. And again, every track has such a different sound.
Well, yeah, Wes Montgomery was huge to Alan. I heard him play a Wes Montgomery lick, and I just went, whoa, that sounded like the real thing. And it was on the same guitar that he was getting these gorgeous legato tones out of, so go figure.
Wow. Let's do another song, one that you recommended, Protocosmos. We've got the live version from then. Tell me about this song.
This was recorded in, I think, 1990 at the Roppongi Pit Inn on a digital recorder. This was an album I argued with Alan about, and finally, you know, he hated his guitar sound on it. But I said, this is so good, you know, we got to put it out. And eventually I think the start of it and the tail, the head and tail of the tune were taken from different nights, because we liked the way he ended it on the prior night's version. And we, you know, so It was a little bit of a splice, but I think it came off seamlessly. Not many people know that. So anyway, enjoy.
We'll be back with Chris and Marco after this. Microcosmos. That's off the Then album. Alan Holdsworth live and with us, a man that has spent a lot of time in the studio and on the road, Chris Hoard. Chris is a good friend of Alan and worked with him in many ways. Chris, you were telling us a great story that particular cut we just heard was edited out of two shows.
Yeah, just the very beginning and end. We liked that end where he bent that note up, as you heard, mm-hmm. and it just, I never thought Alan would do that, but we were just kind of having fun with it in the studio, and we had these two versions, and we said, well, we like that opening bit and that end bit, and Alan said, well, let's try a splice. I said, you know, Alan was a fantastic recording engineer himself. I mean, he was a technologist on many levels, every level you can think about with the guitar, from the engineering and the mixing to actually design guitar processing equipment. He designed alternate scale baritone and piccolo guitars with luthier Bill DeLapp. So he was a tinkerer.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Now, we were talking while we were listening to that about how fast he was playing, but yet the tonal quality of it. And Marco had mentioned that even if you slowed it down, that song would be just as interesting. There's a lot of people that play fast, but to be able to play with that kind of feeling, that's very unique. We're all sitting here with our mouths agape, just going like, wow.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of emotion in what Alan did. If you kind of got a grasp on the harmonies, he had a lot of emotion to express. You know, sometimes it was humor. He was one of the funniest people I've ever met in my life, too. Had a great sense of humor. But I think there was, you know, particularly musicians that sort of understood a little bit about harmonic theory, and they heard how he expressed himself in that medium. Mm-hmm. You know, it seemed like he always had a lot of things to say.
Yeah, it reminds me in some ways of John Coltrane, the way he approaches the music, and that you never know what to expect, but somehow it all just magically works.
Yeah, you know, I mean, several musicians, you know, pretty well-known musicians like Robin Ford and a friend of mine who I was a fan and a follower of early on, like Alan, Lenny White of Return to Forever, mm-hmm. the great drummer who played on Bitches Brew. You know, we were driving along, and we were talking about Alan, and he said, you know, Alan is the John Coltrane of guitar. And I thought, wow, well, I think a lot of jazz people might think that's sacrilegious on some level. But, mm-hmm. You know, I wrote about that in the liner notes to Eidolon, that moment, talking to Lenny about that. And what it was this. Alan said it himself. He said, when I listen to Sonny Rollins or Charlie Parker or, you know, other great, Lester Young, other great jazz sax players, he was a huge fan of jazz saxophone. I mean, mm-hmm. everybody, I mean, he was a huge fan of Michael Brecker and Wayne Shorter, all the greats. And he said, you know, when I first heard Coltrane, it was like there was no lineage. And I said, no lineage? And he goes, yeah, I couldn't figure out where he was coming from before, who he had studied. He just came from somewhere else. And I think a lot of guitarists that heard Alan play, I mean, many of them, you know, at his memorial service, Steve Vai described exactly the same thing, that he just, you know, when they first heard him, they couldn't reference him to anybody that came before. He was mm-hmm. that unique. And I think a lot of musicians who play jazz music, when they heard Coltrane, it was the same thing. And other musicians like Miles Davis, when they played, they just right. came with their own perspective. And it didn't seem to come straight out of what was happening before. It was just different.
Right. Mingus, another one of them.
Yeah, no, exactly. And yet Coltrane had this, I mean, Bill Bruford said this in an interview. He said, you know, he played, Alan played with this sheets of sound kind of effect in his soloing, very much like Coltrane. And obviously Alan listened to Coltrane a great deal, was one of the most influential musicians in his life, as it was for Stanley Clarke and John McLaughlin and many, many others of that great jazz rock era. So, but you know, to do that, you've got to, I think, study hard and maybe just have a sense of your own identity and approach that's very strong. And so I think there are a lot of parallels there. But as I said before, the other thing Alan did was he was really interested in, as he said, shaping the note after he played it.
Mm-hmm.
So while you'll hear a lot of fast notes, for sure, you'll hear some just beautiful growls and effects. You know, I remember some of the Bruford and UK recordings where you'd hear these sounds and they sounded like moans or cries or just otherworldly voicings that he did. He had this vast vocabulary.
Wow, this box set, thank God it came out while he was living and he had a chance to be a part of that and put it all together with you. That had to give him a lot of pleasure to see all of his music from the solo years gathered into one box and then to handpick 28 songs that were personal favorites and put that out there as Eidolon.
Yeah, I would say it gave him a lot of consternation and cause for concern on another level. And I just have to say this because it was funny. I work with the producer, Dan Perloff, who did a fantastic job and just, you know, sought out everybody. And we got a bunch of great photos. And I actually did an interview where we talked about the releases and the box set notes kind of release by release with Alan. But what he said was, I can't stand that title. That title is wrong, you know. And I think there were a whole group of us saying, Alan, you know, whether you can stand it or not, it's true,
mm-hmm.
you know. And he, I think he called Dan a few times and just said, hey, no, you can you change the title? I can't go with that. And we all kind of held firm and said, listen, you know, whether you like it or not, you know, we've just got to do it.
Well, I certainly don't think anyone would argue the fact that he certainly did change guitar forever in so many ways.
Yeah, I just think he didn't like that kind of attention. He didn't ever. He was such a humble band that anything that had, you know, he wanted to demonstrate what he could do. He mm-hmm. didn't want to, you know, he didn't want to proclaim his talent in any way. He wanted people to listen.
Well, what do you think, what was the game plan now that the box set was out and Eidolon was out? I understand he was getting ready to do a lot more touring than he had been. What was the game plan at this point?
Well, he had some dates booked, sadly, in New York for June, I think, at the Iridium, and he was planning to go back to Japan. I saw him play an amazing set literally 5 days before he left us. And had a nice heart-to-heart conversation with him after, and he was, I think, very optimistic about his plans, and then suddenly he was gone. But what I can say is he had unfinished two whole records, at least, of studio tracks. I don't know whether we'll hear them. He hadn't finished a lot of the solos, but I'd heard nearly all of it, and it was amazing. He had a couple records worth of material, new compositions that were, you know, largely done in terms of drum tracks, some featuring the great late L.A. jazz prodigy Austin Peralta, and you know, I think it's. I don't know if that'll ever see the light of day, but on it, you know, I would say he was just always moving forward.
Whose decision will that be? Will that be the family or the production people or Manifesto Records? Who's got the final say on if we're going to get to hear any of those at all?
Right now it's with the family. I'm in touch with the family. I don't know if we will or won't. It's their decision. I suspect that Alan's intention would be that they not be, finished in any way, but I don't know. But
okay.
I think it's something we've got to talk through. What I do know is there's a whole bunch of musicians who've worked with Alan for many years, and, maybe if the family's open to it, let them do it because they worked with Alan on the road for many years, maybe. Maybe there's a thought that they could get involved and, see if they could take it forward.
Okay. We've got about 5 minutes left that we can talk, and then we've got to close out. Would you want to close out with Road Games, or do you want to do the live version of Non-Brewed Condiment, which you said has a Star Trek connection?
Well, I'd say, I'll say something quickly about Road Games. That was an alternate vocal take. There was a big battle with the record company at the time. Eddie Van Halen had kindly gotten Alan a great recording track with a major label, but the executive producers interfered a lot with the music. But Jack Bruce wound up being vocalist on some of the tracks due to that, I'd say, artistic dispute.
Mm-hmm.
But why don't we leave that for the why don't we leave that and go to the other live track, because this is one of the craziest guitar solos I've ever heard him play, which is from Non-Brewed Condiment, which is like this kind of condiment that I think replaces vinegar or something with fish and chips. And Alan found that title always funny for a product that you put on your food.
What is the Star Trek connection, though? As a Trekker, I mean, I was friends with Gene Roddenberry, and I'm listening over and over since you said that. And I'm like, I'm not getting it. I'm not hearing it. I'm failing.
There are a lot of tracks. Mr. Spock was on the Tony Williams Believe It album. There were many songs. Tavercron was the name of the record that came from.
Okay.
That was his favorite episode, where Mr. Spock went back in time, mm-hmm. and shall we say he had a hot date.
Okay. And he's wearing a Star Trek uniform on the cover.
That's right.
Of that as well.
Yeah. So no, he was a huge fan of all things Star Trek, and particularly the original series.
Okay, terrific. Is there anything, Chris, that we haven't talked about?
Well, I could go on endlessly, but suffice to say, I think we've covered quite a bit.
All right. And where can we keep up with everything concerning Alan? Is there a certain website that you're updating through the family or through yourself?
Well, I would, kind of Fan Central, and the family's very active on the Facebook group called The Unreal Alan Holdsworth.
Okay.
That seems to be where a lot of the information, and I participate on that group, and many other fans and friends do. So that's probably the best place to find out.
Okay. And the box set is now out everywhere now, correct?
Yeah. It should be. It's certainly on Amazon if you can't find it in your local record store, as is Eidolon. And, hopefully other albums in the back catalog will continue to be available.
Okay. And Eidolon is a double CD set. And from what I understand from our good friend Ann, he handpicked every one of these songs, all 28. Is that correct? They were personal favorites?
Yeah, yes, they were. And for the most part, it goes in reverse chronological order. So some of the more recent studio recordings are at the front.
Okay. Like I said, I've been living with that album for a while now and just enjoying it. And it takes us to so many places. Marco, any final thoughts with Chris?
Oh, no. This was a pleasure. Great to be here.
All right. Let's do it to it. Chris, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
All right. This is Non-Brewed Condiment, and this is the live version. Listen for that solo.